This is Peter Clarkson, recorded at the Bass headquarters in Cambridge by Chris Alden Lee on the 13th of October 2010. Peter Clarkson, Part 1.
My name is Peter David Clarkson, and I was born in Worcester Park in Surrey, although it's entered on my birth certificate as Wimbledon. Wimbledon, Surrey, which it isn't anymore, on the 19th of June 1945.
What sort of background do you have then? What were your parents occupied?
My father was the, at the time, his occupation on my birth certificate was a toolmaker, but he worked for his father along with his two brothers and eventually a brother-in-law in really a sheet metalworking company. They used to make galvanized hot water tanks. And then when his father retired or died, my father became the managing director. And my mother, she was, I don't know, she worked for the post office during the war. Then she married my father. Curiously, she was a younger sister of two, and her elder sister had married my father's elder brother. So some of my cousins are about as closely related as it's possible to be without actually having the same parents. And anyway, they married, and then I don't know whether she was working then or not. They managed to buy a house in Ewell in Surrey, and 3 years later, approximately, I was born. They were, when they were looking for a house, it was during the war, and they were offered one house, a detached house, which they thought was quite a good choice, because they weren't expecting to be able to afford anything better than a semi. And when they went to see it, they discovered that it had been detached by a bomb. So estate agents haven't changed.
Would you have gone to the ordinary state school, or would you have had a private education?
No, I had a private education. A series of sort of preparatory-type schools, ending up when I was 10, and my brother was, he would have been about 7. We were packed off to a boarding preparatory school. I think probably because my parents, within 3 years, got divorced. And I think although they felt that I wasn't getting the education at the school I was at, I've always had a sneaking suspicion that it was probably to keep us away from the domestic crises that were cropping up. And then in 1958, I went to Epsom College, public school on the edge of Epsom Downs. I was there for just under 6 years, I suppose. That was where I sort of first became aware of the Antarctic, I thought.
Well, Epsom College is noted for producing doctors, not geologists, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Why I came out as a geologist, which was very, very rare, I can only think of one other, I think, who went as became a geologist. But yes, a lot of my friends have since become doctors. They came from medical families. Some of them orphans, or at least where the father usually had died. They could be given foundation scholarships so that their entire education was paid for. And yes, it was something unusual.
So what turned you on to geology?
I did all the usual raft of O-levels, and I thought, I'm not a sort of cultured person, you know. There's no way I'm going to go into the arts side or literature and things like that. It's going to have to be science, which interested me. And then I went to the sixth form to do maths, physics and chemistry. No biology, unfortunately. While I was there, having enjoyed physical geography, but not the political and social geography side, I discovered that there was a science called geology that sort of brought all these things together. And I thought, I'll give it a go. And I was very lucky. I got into University of Durham, and never looked back, really.
And you mentioned in passing, and I stopped you from telling me, about your first brush with the Antarctic.
Yes, well, I thought that... I always remembered following Sir Vivian Fuchs's Transantarctic expedition, and I read the book, and I thought, this is fantastic. And then while I was at Epsom, they had a book in the chemistry library called The Principles of Physical Geology by Arthur Holmes, who at one time was the, as it happens, was the prof of geology at Durham. But there was a particular photograph in there of part of the Sorondan Mountains in Dronningmoorland, these huge vertical cliffs about 800 metres high. And it's a fabulous photograph. And when you read the caption, it says, the arrow denotes the dog team. Well, you've got to look really hard to see the arrow, let alone the dog team. And I saw this and I thought, wow, you know, this is fantastic. Then when I got up to Durham, I discovered that there was an outfit called the British Antarctic Survey, which actually paid for you to go to the Antarctic. And I got my first taste of the polar regions, I suppose, almost, when I was in the sixth form. There was a master who was a member of the Alpine Club, and he'd got some money to take some boys to Iceland to see if a group of mountains were sort of climbable. And I don't know how it happened now, but I went on the trip, and I thought, yeah, this is great.
Had you been the adventurous type? Are you a tree climber?
Well, yeah, I suppose in a way, yes. Yes. Well, no, I'd been a wolf cub. And then when I went to Epsom, I didn't join the Boy Scouts for some reason, but we were all drafted into the CCF, and we had to do basic training in the Army section, and then I opted for the RAF section. I would have gone for a naval section if they had one, but they didn't. So I went to the RAF section. And that was more fun because we had this string bag glider that we used to assemble on a Friday afternoon and launch down the playing fields. That was good fun, you know, better than marching around a living quadrangle all day.
When did you write your letter to Bass, then, if that's what happened in the end?
Oh, I suppose it was Bill Sloman came up to Durham on the recruiting round, and I went to the lecture, and I thought this sounds good, so I applied for the job. I was really very lucky to get it. It was really the only job I applied for. The only other letter I wrote was to the professor of geology in Iceland to see whether they got any vacancies. And it was only 2 or 3 years ago that I found out that the Icelandic geology department was two people at the time, not likely to grow any bigger. But so that was that, and I went down to London for interview, interviewed by Bill Sloman and Ray Ady, and obviously I satisfied them.
Do you remember much about that interview?
I can remember Ray Ady asking me if I knew how a proton precession magnetometer worked. And I said, I haven't got to that stage in my revision yet. and the other question is, he said, if you found, lead minerals in a mineral vein, what else would you expect to find with them? So I reeled off two or three other minerals and... my mind went blank, and I just said, and of course, many of the other gang minerals that we find in the Northern Pennine ore field. And obviously, he accepted that.
Was it strenuous, this interview, or did you feel as though perhaps was in the bag already?
Yeah. Oh, I certainly never felt that. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was a particularly strenuous interview.
What do you make of those two men? Because their names are quite famous in Bass circles. Bill Sloman and Ray Ady. What's your memories of those two chaps?
Ray Ady was a strange man. He became my boss, of course, for many years, and he seemed to find it very difficult to relate to his staff. He was always very formal. It was always Dr. Ady and Clarkson. And I remember an occasion on the Bransfield once when we were having a drink in the lounge after dinner, And Ray came down from the wardroom, and he walked across to us, and somebody pulled a chair up and thrust a pint of beer in his hand. And he looked around the assembled company, and they were all sorts of people there, GAs, cooks and so on. And he said, "Hello, Fred. Hello, Jim." And he looked at me and he said, "Hello, Clarkson." You know, he couldn't get out of it. And it was a great pity, really, because I think he would have had a great deal more respect from us if he'd been a little bit easier and more open with us. Sad, really. He'd done some very good geology in his time, but that was all he did. After that, his original time south, at Stonington, Hope Bay and Stonington Island, he never really did any more geology. And he used to go to conferences, and he usually gave a review paper. And one American was overheard coming up to him after one of his presentations and saying, excellent presentation, Ray. Same old stuff, though. And unfortunately, it was the 1977 Earth Science Conference in Wisconsin. And I think it was Bob Pankhurst who by that time had got a large number of dates on the granites and so on of the Antarctic Peninsula, and shown that they were nearly all Mesozoic in age, and that Ray's Paleozoic basement just really didn't fit. And at the end of the paper, he got up and turned on his heel and walked out. He could have redeemed everything, really, if he had stood up and said, "It is great at last to get some dates on these rocks, and we now find really how old they are. And unfortunately, my early ideas no longer hold water. But that's because we have new data. The science has advanced." But unfortunately, he didn't take that view.
When you say he might have had more respect, then, can you elaborate on that slightly from the point of view of the people working under him? Was he? That suggests a kind of a proud man, doesn't it?
Yes, he was, I think. And I mean, he had a lot to be proud of. One of the, probably, in many ways, the most prescient paper he ever wrote was about the Falkland Islands, just based on the geology that he did in the Falkland Islands and what he'd done in South Africa before he came to Britain. He suggested that the Falkland Islands had originally been rotated through 180 degrees and locked into a position just east of South Africa. And then when the Gondwana supercontinent broke up, they got moved across to South America. And it was a paper that I think it was in the Geological Magazine, but nobody paid a great deal of attention to it at the time, which was a great pity. But then plate tectonics hadn't really been invented then, and a lot of people still didn't believe in continental drift. And then, probably in the late 80s, a group from Oxford Brookes University had gone down to the Falkland Islands to do some paleomagnetic work, and I can't remember his name, but the chap who was sort of leading the trip, when he'd got some results, he came across here and was talking to Mike Thompson, and he said, "We've got something really good here. We are able to show that, that the Falkland Islands have been translated and rotated, and nobody's ever said that before." And Mike said, "Well, actually," and leant out into his bookcase and pulled out Ray's paper. Yeah, it was a pity. I think if he hadn't tried... I mean, one of the strange things that he said to the new fiddlers, new geology people, which didn't really affect me because I didn't go to the peninsula initially, was, "I don't want you talking to these other people who've just come back from the Antarctic, because you'll get preconceived ideas." And... it was almost as if everybody was expected to go down there for the first time and work in a total vacuum. And that was silly. Of course, we did talk to the others and we found out an awful lot of useful things. but a shame in many ways.
And what about Bill Sloman?
Bill Sloman, yeah.
Because nearly every kid I talked to was handpicked by Bill Sloman, it seems.
Yes. I had tremendous respect for Bill. His personnel selection was almost faultless. He made inevitably one or two mistakes, but they were very, very rare. But then I have to say, on the other hand, I never quite trusted Bill in certain respects. There was an unfortunate case in the 1977-78 season when I'd gone back to the Shackleton Range. This time we were using twin otters. We were working out of the Argentine base at General Belgrano, using it as a staging post. And for a whole series of reasons, I was the only one who came home. The other three had to spend the winter at Belgrano, which upset me very, very greatly. We had said we'll stay together. But when the pilot was leaving with the first load, he said, look, I can take however many passengers it was. And that meant one of us was to go. And we said, no, we'd rather stay together. You know, we'd done the season together. And he said, well, I'm not going without one of you. And we sort of looked at one another, and I said, OK. And I got on the plane.
Was that an American pilot?
No.
British pilot.
British. Yeah. And flew back to Rothera. We didn't actually get to Rother initially. We ran into bad weather and had to land on Alexander Island. We spent 5 nights there because we had to get into Fossil Bluff to refuel. We didn't know quite where we were on Alexander Island, and we had to wait until we could be sure that the weather was not only good for us, but good for a landing at Fossil Bluff. Anyway, we did it in the end. Those three lads were left behind. And when I came back here to Cambridge, I bumped into Bill one day, and he said, "Oh, come and see me. Want to chat about the season?" "Yeah, fine." So he called me into his office a few days later, and as I walked into the door, he said, "What the hell are you doing here? Captain goes down with his ship." Well, anyway, once I'd explained the situation, he was fine about it. But, the end of my first winter at Halley, or the end of the first year when the ship came in, it was unfortunate that all the base supply of booze and all the, the private stocks of booze were all offloaded from the Pearl of Dan at the same time, and they were all stacked up in the garage. Now, if you look at that sort of amount of booze for 30 men for a year, it's a hell of a big pile of stuff. And Bill saw this lot and nearly went apoplectic. But when you actually got down to it, it didn't work out at any more than a pint of beer per man per day, really. And it's not a lot, but it looks an awful lot in one place. And I forget whether it was to me the following relief or whether at that time, but there was some question about what was being done at the relief, and he said, "Well, you're the man in charge here, you're the base commander, you're in charge, we're just observers." And I thought, oh, yeah, pretty powerful observers. So I got a bit upset about that, but anyway.
It doesn't matter if we dart around chronologically at all, because that's fine. So, as you brought up the question of the three chaps being left behind at Belgrano, this is Dog, Holden, Marsh and Wright.
That's right.
You say in your base reports at the time that they were therefore subject to the most adverse conditions likely to be encountered on any base anywhere in the Antarctic. So, how bad was it?
Oh, it was absolutely appalling.
Why? What
was wrong? The whole place was falling apart. It was on the ice shelf, so I mean, just like Halley, it was subject to all the movements in the ice shelf. But I spent about 10 days there, I think. And I remember, you know, you go to bed one night and you go to open the bunk room door. You couldn't open it because the building shifted slightly. And eventually you wrenched it open. You know, it was fine. Wrenched it shut. The next morning you got up and you put your shoulder at the door, but the building had moved again during the night, and he went straight through the door. At one stage, we were standing talking in a corridor, and there was this hell of a crash. Something had shifted, and a large number of bottles of the base booze supply, Argentine wine, the rack had collapsed, all fell to the floor. They showed us a film one night, and we were sitting there watching this film, and suddenly thought that we could smell something burning. And we looked across, and there was the projector was plugged into the socket on the wall with a plastic plug, and this plug was just melting and dripping down the wall. The classic was when we were always getting power cuts because they'd only got one generator that worked, and the Brits who were there at the time would each time the power went off, we'd just get up and we'd move across to the rack of hurricane lamps and tilly lamps and start to light them. But on this occasion, the base commander came through and he said, "No problemo, no problemo, 10 minutos." So 10 minutos came and went, and another 10, and then we started to light the lamps. And it transpired what had happened was that the fan belt on the generator had broken. Now, if it had been one of our generators, they normally had 3 fan belts on them. But no, this only had the one. So they put a new fan belt on, pressed the button in within the 10 minutos, but it wouldn't start. "Oh, the battery's flat." "Right, we need another battery." "We haven't got one." "Oh, right, well, we'll have to put one on charge." So they got a battery and charging it with a little Honda generator. And then Pedro comes past with his hurricane lamp, walks across the top of the battery, bang! Blows up that battery. So, okay, they find another one, put that on charge and leave it for a few hours to charge. Then they put it back on the generator, press the button, and the thing wouldn't turn over. It got too cold. "Ah, right, where is the hot air blower?" So the hot air blower was just outside the generator shed, completely entombed in ice. So they had to chip all this ice off it until they get enough ice off to get it working. Then they turn it on itself to eventually to dry it out a bit. Then they turn it on the engine, and then after it's been on the engine for a few hours to warm the oil in the sump, they put the new battery on, press the starter, and away we went. 8 hours to change a fan belt, in effect.
But wasn't that a military base, wasn't it? Were the
operating in military
conditions?
Yes. Yes, but then we saw the effectiveness of the Argentine military in...
Oh, we did. In 1984.
Falklands. Yeah. 82.
82, sorry.
Yes. and there were all other things. So at one stage, the lads contacted me, I think while I was still at Rothera, because we'd arranged for the Russians to pick them up. But the Russians didn't when they left, and it was well over a year later before we found out why. We just couldn't understand it.
They sailed without them, didn't they?
Yeah, and apparently it was just that it was the end of the season, right at the head of the Weddell Sea. You don't want to stay down there longer than you help, and the weather was too bad for flying the helicopters when they passed the base. Well, they knew the lads were safe, so they carried on. But it was a bad do.
But relationships with the Russians have been quite good, apart from that.
Oh, yes, yes.
This is between 77, 78.
Yes. Yeah, there wasn't a problem. The only thing was they just didn't let us know why. I mean, it was perfectly understandable why they didn't pick them up.
There was also a note in the report about Surveyor refusing to go and get them. Is that right? Was that part of the Russian?
No. It was one of the other Tuonata pilot who was at Rothera. He tended to fly entirely by the book, and I'll tell you a bit more about that in a moment, because we told him that, or at least our pilot at Belgrano said, the weather's fine here, and it's continental, it's going to stay fine for a while, just come. Well, they took off from Rothera, and they flew into deteriorating weather. And yet we were continuing to tell them, it's fine outside, you know, you've just got to cross the peninsula, you can't put no turn back. And he probably had a more dangerous flight back in deteriorating weather at Rotherham. But that was part of the reason. And then, what happened after that? Once we got the Russian screamer to pick them up, it was 80, said that the aircraft could go home. And so the Gary Studd in with one twin otter, this was before the runway at Rotherham, using the skiway, and he was very fully loaded because they had the ferry tanks in for the long flight back to Punta Arenas. And he went down the skiway. He'd got his flight engineer sitting right in the tail of the aircraft. And at one stage he hit a bump which threw him up in the air long enough to stay airborne. Well, the other pilot, he had his engineer sitting beside him in the cockpit because they weren't supposed to be down at the tail of the airplane. He hit a big bump, possibly the same one, and instead of being thrown into the air, it pushed the nose oleo up into the cockpit. And so that was the end of that. That aircraft we then eventually packed up and brought home on the Bransfield. But we had a Canadian twin otter came through at that time. I can't remember why or what it was doing, but they got a damaged tail fin or damaged rudder. And so they swapped it with the one of our twin otter. And then when they knew that the Russians hadn't picked up these lads, they said, well, we'll fly back and get them. And I was talking with Dave Fletcher, and I said, there's no way we can allow them to do that, because if anything happens to them, there's not an aircraft on the continent now that can go and help them. And so, you know, it was very upsetting, but I had to say to the lads who'd got wind of this, if they had, I can't remember, but, you know, no, we can't do it. And they also said, they came back to us and said, look, we've got our skidoos here at Belgrano. We could drive up to Halle. And I had to say no. Nobody knew the way to go. They hadn't got any maps. It was, I don't know, 300 miles, something like that. Winter was coming on. No, you're going to have a hell of a winter, but you're going to be safe. Anything could happen if you try and get up to Halle.
These are tough calls for a base leader, aren't they?
Yes, they are. And I still think about it. Fortunately, the three concerned, we still all exchange Christmas cards, and we're friends when we meet. I don't think they hold it against me, but I suppose I hold it against myself more than anything.
Well, I'm seeing them in Windermere in November. I'll find out more. You know, that's fascinating. Thank you very much for talking about that. Let's go back chronologically to your first steps with British Antarctic Survey. You've been appointed as a geologist.
That's right.
And you were sent south, and you ended up in Halle.
Yes.
Because of the Shackleton Mountains? Or?
Yeah, I was due to go to the Shackleton Range. Now, when I arrived at Halle, the tractor parties had come back from the Theron Mountains, so that the tractors were back to do the relief. But the two dog teams were still out, and they were trying, they were probably on their way back by then, but they'd been trying to get to the Shackleton Range. And Slessor Glacier, which lies between the Therons and the Shackletons, is impassable. It would be a major mountaineering expedition to get across it on foot. There was no way you could get a dog team across. So they needed to go all the way around the end of the head of the glacier. And so it was decided at relief, although I wasn't party to any of this, that the Shackleton Range were too far for us to have to reach overland and maintain mountain field parties every season. You'd have to have a depot laying season one year, and then the next you'd depot lay again, but there'd be enough stuff to keep the field parties in the mountains happy. And so they said, well, what are we going to do with Clarkson? And I actually saw this in a telegram later. I have a copy of it. I said, OK, what do we do with Clarkson? And I was probably going to come home again. But they decided that why don't we go back to Vestfjella? It's where the geologists and surveyors were going in 1965 when the three lads were lost in a tractor accident at what became known as Manafell Nalsana. Originally it was Stella Nunatax. So that was it. I stayed. But of course, nobody really wanted to go to the Vestfjell. We wanted to go to the Shackleton Range. And anyway, it was about May, I think, when the news came into Halley that the Norwegians had already arranged with the Americans for a party to go to Vestfjella. And so Fuchs said, well, I don't know what we'll do, but, you know, maybe we can sort of have half the range each, something like that. But then Fuchs went off to the SCAR meeting in Tokyo. And while he was there, he was chatting with the Americans. And the Americans were saying, what are you doing? And so he explained, and they said, oh, well, you know, we've got photographs of the Shackleton Range, also Theron's and Which Way Non Attacks. And we want the ground control, but strangely, we can't get hold of surveyors very easily. And Bunny said, oh, we can get surveyors, that's not a problem, but we just can't get there. And so they said, well, if we flew you there, could you provide the surveyors? We'll give you a set of the photographs, and could you put in the ground control? And Bunny said, yeah, okay.
This was August 1968.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so suddenly it was all on, and we got the news at Halley that the Americans were going to fly in a party of two surveyors and two GAs into the Shackleton Range. So Chris Sykes, the base commander, wrote back and he said, well, that's all very well, but we do have two geologists here on base and they should have priority. And Bunny came back and he said, yes, I agree, but the deal is survey or no flights. And he said, but of course, you may be able to fit them in. And so we repacked everything, removing as much weight as possible to get us to be able to take a six-man party. So Mike Skidmore and I always felt, went as excess baggage.
Hitchhikers. First, I think the word he uses is hitchhikers.
Hitchhikers, okay. so we actually got there. Now, the interesting thing is, why did the Americans have these trimetric in-air photographs? And it goes back to just before I arrived at Halley. The previous doctor, John Brotherhood, had been out with Jim Shercliffe doing some physio work, but they were man-hauling in whiteout, and they walked over a cliff. Jim broke his ankle, John Brotherhood, he probably fractured his cheek and he'd hurt his back, but he said he wasn't too bad. Ricky Chin, the base commander, did not actually believe him. He thought he was just being brave about it. And so there was some messages went back to London and the question of air evacuation was raised. So the Americans, I believe John Brotherhood's father was an air marshal, something like that, which may have made negotiations somewhat easier. But anyway, the Americans flew over to pick him up and then flying back to McMurdo and Christchurch. And they sent two aircraft, but one of them was sort of acting as communications relay and search and rescue. And to give it something to do, it took all these trimetric and photographs. So I got to the Shackleton Range all because John Brotherhood walked over a cliff. So I've never forgotten that.
What is it about the Shackletons that made you... What's so special about them? Why are they a geologist's holy grail?
I don't know exactly a holy grail, but they are geologically very interesting. They're right on the sort of borderline between the ancient cratons of Greater Antarctica and the Transantarctic Mountains. They were actually discovered by the Argentines a few months before Fuchs' Antarctic expedition discovered them. But the Argentines never followed up the discovery. I think they called them something like the Cordon Los Manucos, something like that. Fuchs called it the Shackleton Range, because Shackleton, in 1914, would have discovered them if he'd actually landed.
That means they've been discovered three times now, hasn't it?
And because they're linked with the name of Shackleton, and it's a large area of mountains, about half the size of Wales. There was just something sort of magical about it. And this was funny. Just after we heard that we were going to be flown to the mountains, I walked into the garage at Halley to borrow a spanner or something. And I'd always been very good about borrowing stuff, because I made sure that somebody saw me take it and somebody saw me take it back. So they knew that I was reliable and their tools wouldn't disappear. And one of the big International Harvester bulldozers was in the garage, and Dad Etchells was bending over the blade doing something or other. He looked up and he saw me and he said, "Go away," or words to that effect. And he said it with such venom, you know, I was completely taken aback. And I said, "What's the matter?" And he said, "Isn't our bloody transport good enough for you then?" Then it was all right, he let me borrow the spanner. But they were going to go to the Shackleton Range anyway. And there was a big hoarding across the garage door that said, "We're off to the Shackleton Range. Where are you lot off to?" and of course, they did go to the Shackleton Range. And they laid that super depot right in the eastern end of the range, which was a lifesaver for us when we eventually got there. Not just that one season, but the first season. We didn't get there the first season. But the second, third, and fourth seasons, it was great, and perhaps more by luck than judgment, I don't know. But it was superbly sited. It was on the top of a slight snow rise, and when we got there first time, so about 2 years after it had been laid, the snow was just level with the tops of the boxes. The food boxes, which was a stack just one high. And we did the normal thing. We dug up all the boxes, put it back on the surface, and we came through again about a fortnight later, and the snow was level with the tops of the boxes. Wonderful sighting.
So the first time you had to turn back because you hadn't taken enough rations with you, is that correct? The first year, when you tried to get to the Shackletons? Or have I got the wrong end of the stick there?
No. Not me personally, I never turned back, because we were flown in by the Americans. But when Mike Skidmore and Pete Noble, they'd managed to get around the end of the Slesser Glacier, and they could see the mountains, which they thought were 50 miles away. Mm. And they certainly didn't have enough food and fuel to get there and back. They could probably have done it. They'd have eked things out. And I don't know, I think if I'd been in their position, I might have been tempted to do that. But I don't know quite what the detail of their situation was. But so they turned back. While Nick Mathis and John Galsworthy, they'd been going northeast, northwest, direct from the head of the Slesser Glacier towards Halley to try to prove the route that way.
So when was the first time you got there then?
It was in November, December 68.
Right. Okay. And you were flown all the way or part?
Yes. No, we were flown all the way. And the Americans, they got the Norwegians at McMurdo, so they put the Norwegians on board. They flew up to the pole with the Norwegians. They refueled. They then flew to Vestfjella. They dropped the Norwegians. They flew on to Halley. They refueled at Halley. Picked us up, flew down to the Shackleton Range, dropped us off, then back to Pole and McMurdo. And it was the longest mission that had been flown from McMurdo at that time. And I think they all got Antarctic Service medals for it. They might have got military medals as well, I don't know, because they were all naval flyers.
So having got to the Shackletons, what did you find, and did it surprise you at all?
It didn't surprise us too much, because, of course, John Stevenson of the Transantarctic Expedition had already done the geology, or some geology, in the western end. So we started off at the western end of the range, which wasn't far from where we'd been dropped. And we went to various places that he'd been to just to familiarise ourselves with the rocks that he'd seen, and so that we could then extend the survey that he had started. And that was what we did. Looking back, he was either extremely lucky or extremely bright, because he saw just about all the key exposures in the western end of the range, and I don't know, he did very well. I mean, it was a great report. It was a wonderful basis for us to work on, and the basic sort of stratigraphic sequence that he set up is still there today. It's been modified and refined, but the basis is still there.
So yours wasn't so much an expedition of discovery; it was a substantiating previous work.
It was to start with. It was substantiating, but then we moved away from where he'd been, and we saw a lot more of the range. And then eventually, over the coming three seasons, I saw all the rest of it, bar one outcrop. One of the curious things is that you have these Beacon supergroup sediments with the dolerite sills intruding them in the Theron Mountains to the north, and then in the Whichway Nunataks to the south. But nowhere do you see them in the Shackleton Range. There is a big peneplain that extends over the whole of the centre of the Shackleton Range, and we've no idea the age of the peneplain, really. It might be glacial, it could be the equivalent of the Kukri peneplain on which the Beacon sediments lie elsewhere, or could even be something older, being exhumed, we just don't know. But we never saw any Beacon at all, and it was the last time I was there, it was with John Wright, and we were using skidoos that time, and we were right in the eastern end of the range. We'd got big sastrugi, 2 feet or so high. It was beautiful sunny weather. It was blowing about 20 knots most of the time, and it was not easy travelling and not very pleasant despite the sunshine. And John sort of said to me, well, that's the easternmost outcrop on the northern side. Do you want to go there? I got the binoculars out and I looked and I thought, well, it looks much the same as everything else. But I said, if there's any beacon, that's where it's going to be. And anyway, we didn't go. Years later, I was talking to a German colleague, George Kleinschmidt, who followed into the Shackleton Range with the German expeditions years later. And I said, did you ever get to that place? He said, oh, yes. And I said, well, what was the rock? And he said, I don't know. It's completely different to anything else. I said, it was not beacon. Well, he said, it's all sort of mucked up volcanics and stuff like that. And he said, it could be very basal beacon, but it's not actually clear, and we're really not sure. And I said, I knew it was going to be something different. You know? But he did another thing. There was, on top of the peneplain above, fairly near the centre of the range, on the south side, I'd come across a little outcrop of quartzite. I mean, I say little, it wasn't much bigger than this room. And it was actually deposited on the peneplain. Whether it had been thrust there or not, I don't know, but anyway, it was there. And George said to me, when I went into the Shackleton, I had your maps with me, and we were flying in helicopters, and I was looking for this outcrop. And he said, I flew up and down, and I started to think, I don't know, Peter must have been mistaken. And then he said, suddenly we saw it. He said, small? How did you ever find it? So, some redemption.
But you were finding you were substantiating, in some respects, Ray Ader's theory of continental drift, weren't you, of the various particles of Gondwana land?
Yes, we certainly had. We were certainly thinking about that. Yes.
Tell me a bit about that.
Well, I suppose we were helping to sort of substantiate the fact that the Transantarctic Mountains, which form the margin of Greater Antarctica all the way across the continent, is probably the edge of a major craton, and that everything to the west has appeared since then, particularly the Ellsworth Mountains, which appear to, well, at the time we thought that they'd come from somewhere up near Halley Bay. And they'd be moved as the continent started to fragment. But that idea went out of fashion for a long time. But I believe it's now back in fashion again, and people think that. But we're not. It's very difficult to find out quite what's going on because there's so little outcrop in that area. Mm-hmm. And remote sensing using radio echo sounding for ice thickness and bedrock elevation, aeromagnetics, seismic and all this sort of thing can only tell you so much, we really need to see the rocks.
Well, there's a certain amount of excitement in your reports from those years, from 68, 69. Well, as a layman, it almost feels as if you found the place where Tasmania and South Africa had met.
No, I don't think I can claim anything like that.
The two generations of magma, one from
this was much later work that was done with Tim Brewer, who sadly died a couple of years ago, very early age. But he was basically working on the rocks that Dave Brooke had collected from the Theron Mountains and had never written up, and then we extended that to some of the basic rocks in Murray Birdland, and he was responsible for all the geochemistry and so on. And it did appear to us once we got the results that we were looking at two basaltic provinces, and that this was what Dave Brooke had always suspected in the Theron Mountains. And I think this the work that we did helped to show this. Mm-hmm. We didn't convince everybody. Keith Cox of Oxford, who was the Ferrar Dolerite man, so to speak, a Karoo intrusion man, he didn't really believe us, I think. And I don't know whether anybody sort of followed up the work in recent years, but it seemed a good idea at the time. And one of the great things about geology is that if you get a bit of evidence that points towards a certain theory at this stage, you can go ahead and put it forward. And while a lot of people might not believe that you're right, if they haven't got any evidence to the contrary, they can't actually say that you're wrong. And it's not just in geology, but in all sorts of science, this is the way it progresses. You know, people have got to put up these straw men from time to time.
Well, how's your thinking progressed in 40 years? Are you now convinced of Ader's theories of continental drift? And
oh yes, absolutely, no doubt about it. And but I think the outstanding problems for the plate tectonics of Lesser Antarctica is what was the orientation of the peninsula. It's convinced, as I think are most people, that the tip of the peninsula was originally tucked in close to Tierra del Fuego somewhere. But we don't know whether it was in a straight line with the rest of the Andean chain or whether it was swung round. It's possible that the area between Murray Birdland and the Transantarctic Mountains, where you've got the Ellsworths and then these various other small mountain groups, they're all sort of bits of microcontinental fragment. But as I was just saying, until we can really know what's going on under the ice, we won't know this. Mm. But there might be there might be oceanic crust within what is now Lesser Antarctica. The Bentley subglacial trough is one possibility.
How are relationships on that season? There were one or two suggestions that not only got on with everybody else, there were a couple of accidents for a start which didn't help things.
No, that's right. I think we all got on well enough that season. It was the next season where there were slight strain, I think, amongst the surveyors. But no, Nick Mathis broke his leg, and we cursed him for it. We hadn't got good communications with Halley at the time, and Mike Skidmore was sending out the message to Halley by Morse that said Nick has broken leg, and the tractor parties picked this up, and whoever was doing the Morse there worked out that Nick has broken neck, and they were about to turn back to come and pick him up, and I don't know quite how it happened, but they were dissuaded from doing so, because if the injury was sufficiently serious, we'd have just called up the Americans, but we didn't. Ken Blakelock, of long-standing British Antarctic fame, had come down to restart the survey that he'd started in the during the Transantarctic expedition, and he said, if we call the Americans, they're almost certainly going to say one out, all out. Hmm. So we put this to Nick, and he said, "Yeah, okay." Very stoical, actually, Nick Mathis. And anyway, eventually got him back to the depot on the Recovery Glacier, so-called. we all met up there. And then Ken and Harry Wiggins went off to carry on the survey, while the other four of us, Mike Skidmore, Tony True, and myself, and, of course, the patient Nick, set about fixing his leg. And by this time, fortunately, we'd got quite good radio communications with Halley, and the doctor was on the radio at the other end, and he said, "Well, can you see the break, or can you feel the break?" And, "Yeah, we can actually see it. He'd only broken his shin bone," and so he said, "Well, right, well, turn his foot until the break disappears." Turn his foot. And, right. Now, does his leg look in a fairly straight line? Yeah. And looks right to us from this end, from the foot. You know, what's it look like to you, Nick? And he said, "Fine, go on, slap the plaster on." So they shot the plaster on, and he spent the rest of the that season lying up.
So the decision not to call the Americans was not so much to do with medical assessments, but to do with the project as a whole.
Yeah.
We'd
obviously satisfied ourselves that he was in no real danger. Mm. I think probably by the time he's probably got his leg in plaster for about 6 weeks, and so it's virtually healed by the time he got back to Halley. And he's fine now, you know. It has been for nearly 40 years.
There's a comment from Blakelock in the logs at the time saying that Nick Mathis was uncooperative and lacking initiative.
Nick was the nominal leader of the expedition, and I'd sort of forgotten that, I suppose. He was always a bit plodding and following things by the book, and Ken was Ken got years and years of experience, and he just knew what would go and what wouldn't. And in fact, at one stage, Ken and Harry had a dog team each, and the system they were using was that you sledged to point A. This is what they would have been doing. The other party then sledged to point B. They measured the line and did the angles, and then the party at point A would leapfrog the others and go to point C, and then they do the thing, and they keep doing like that. But then immediately after the accident, when they regrouped, Ken and Harry, they were sledging from... they'd sledged to point A, dump a load of kit. Then they sledged to point B, where Harry would leave Ken with the pyramid tent. Harry would then sledge back to point A on his own. They'd measure the line and so on, having had a quick crash course in using a telerometer and a theodolite. And then Harry would sledge back to point B, pick up Ken, and then they'd repeat the whole thing, B to C, and so on. But then finally, they had a dog team each, and they were just leapfrogging one another. Mm. And they didn't tell London quite how they were operating. But Ken said, Bunny's looked at the telegrams. He'll know what we're doing. But we're not actually going to tell him what we're doing. He can work it out for himself. And speaking to Bunny later, he said, yes, well, I didn't know what they were doing. But while I hadn't been told, I didn't have to stop it. And he knew Ken very well, so he was quite happy with that.
There was some argument about where to form base camp. Matthews wanted to form base camp 2 hours searching from the mountains, and Blakelock wanted it to be much nearer.
That's right. Because when the Hercules put us down, the first landing they did, I don't know what we landed on, it was in thick cloud. And as the skis touched down, they went bang, 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 bang. Whether we were flying, whether they were hitting sastrugi or crevasses, what we never found out. But there was a sudden roar of full throttle, and then we went round, and eventually they landed us. And God knows how he put it down. You couldn't see anything. I was only looking at one of the photographs today, actually, and there's the photograph of the aeroplane, but you can see it's total mank all the way around. And they threw everything out the back, 27 dogs, 6 men, and all the kit. And it was, they kept the engines going, so there's all this unburnt after fumes coming back, and it was dreadful. But within, I don't know how long it took us to unload, perhaps it was about 40 minutes, I don't know. But, and then suddenly they said, right, we're off, see you in 3 months. Vroom. And within a matter of yards, they disappeared into the Manx, and we didn't see them again. When it was about 2 days before the weather cleared, when we found out where we were way out, 20 miles out onto Recovery Glacier. And the point was that not only was it, it's called Recovery Glacier because that's where one of Bunny's tractors had a major accident, that they got it out. And it was ridiculous if we'd led the camp where it was, because it would have been difficult to find. It's virtually a day's travel for us with dogs out onto the glacier, and it would be just a spot in the middle of nowhere. There was a serious danger that we might not have found it again. So we spent 10 days ferrying all our supplies to within a few miles of the mountains. About 20 miles we ferried them, and it did take a lot of time, but it certainly made sense.
Shouldn't it have been actually, according to Blakelock, even nearer the mountains?
Well, he probably would have liked it nearer, yes. Yeah.
And what was the reason for not doing that, do you remember?
It was just, we were just losing too much time just ferrying stuff.
Yeah.
Once we'd done 20 miles, that was probably near enough, you know.
There's reference to the mobsters being leaderless, and I wonder what the story about that?
I think a dog called Shem was supposed to be the leader of the mobsters, and... he wasn't really a particularly good leader. He also used to go peculiar every full moon. You know, it was quite entertaining, really. Suddenly he'd stand up, look up, and he'd throw his head back, and he'd have a howl, and then he'd look down, and he'd stare at the snow, and he'd dig, 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 dig down into the snow, stand up, howl at the moon, and go back and dig a bit more. Oh, that was unreal. But he wasn't a particularly good leader. Unlike the Beatles, which had a dog called Bala Suak, normally known as Suak, he was an import from Greenland several years earlier. And driving Suak was like driving a car. You know. He just said, "Oh," and turned around. He was brilliant.
For somebody who obviously has a great soft spot for dogs, you seem to actually have a sneaking regard for the International Harvest bulldozers as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they were wonderful workhorses. Used to pull 12 tons in the field. Dad Etchells really was the driving force, I think, for getting those into the field and doing all the work that they did. He was a great man, actually. Very. You've interviewed him, I think.
Yeah, but tell me about yes. People never talk about themselves the same way. Other people talk about them.
He never said a lot. He just got on with the job, and
he hasn't changed much.
And he always ensured that any vehicle that he took into the field was in as near tip-top condition as he could make it. And he never had, as far as I'm aware, any major mechanical breakdowns. There was a story of an epic trip with Muskeg tractors once where somebody actually had to change a crankshaft in the hinge zone south of Halley. They had to put the tent up over the engines, and the temperature was minus 40 or something. It all sounds terribly heroic, but you have to ask yourself, why did he not check that before he left? I mean, I don't know the details of the story, but certainly Dad never wanted to be put into that position. As far as I'm aware, he never was.
One of the little details before we took a break was you ended up doing some surgeon's work on Mike Skidmore's lip, which is, I mean, how was a geologist qualified to stitch somebody's lip back together again?
Oh, totally unqualified.
Why was it you that did it?
Because there were just the two of us there at the time. We were in the Herbert Mountains, and the highest mountain in the Herbert Mountains is called Mount Absalom, named by the TAE for one of their committee members. And it was a rather fine peak, and Mike and Pete Noble had seen this when they'd been on the Advance recce the year before, and so it was something to aim for. You know, we were there just to do the geology, but it happened to be Christmas Eve, and we thought, wouldn't it be great to see the New Year in on the summit? So we had an early supper. And then...
When you said Christmas Eve, you meant New Year's Eve.
Sorry, I meant New Year's Eve, yes. We had an early supper. We made up a flask of cocoa, which was laced with some rum ration. And we set off. We took some geology kit because there was an outcrop high up on the ridge that would justify actually going up there, you see. So we got up, we had a look at the rock, and then we carried on up the ridge. Not a great distance. And then there was this snow face, about 200 feet high, I suppose, that led onto the top was the side of a ridge that went onto the summit. And we started, we didn't have ropes, we didn't have crampons, we did have ice axes. And we started kicking steps up this. And I was leading, or at least not leading, I was in front. I came to a couple of icy bands. They were about a foot high. So I couldn't kick into those. I had to kick over them. And I turned to Mike and I said, there's a couple of icy bands here. And I said, are you all right? And you happy with this? And I said, because remember, he who's scared and runs away lives to climb another day. And he said, no, I'm fine. So I turned back to the face, took another step, and I heard, ah! And I looked round, and it was horrific. You know what it looks like when you throw a rag doll downstairs, their arms and legs go everywhere. And that was how Mike was cartwheeling down this snow slope for about, I think I said about 150 feet. Then he hit the scree and he bounced down the scree for about 50 feet. And I, still facing the cliff but turning round, I shouted down, are you all right, Mike, you all right? And he replied, thank God for that, at least he's alive, you know. So I reversed down this snow slope as quickly as I could and got to him. And he sort of I think he'd sat up by then, and I said, come on, what's wrong? Have you broken anything? And all his limbs were all right. He did have, he probably actually had a hairline fracture of his cheekbone, something like that. And anyway, I said, do you think you can walk? So we got him to his feet. We got no drink, not even, and particularly not, we'd lost the cocoa with laced with rum that was in the thermos flask. The thermos flask was smashed. But I never forgave him for that. And anyway, we staggered back down to the tent, and I got him into the tent, and I said, come on, let's strip you off and find out, you know, what's wrong. And he's quite badly bruised, as you can imagine. And also, I could see, he got a hole in his top lip. I could see his tooth through the lip. So I said, I think I'm going to have to stitch your lip. So he said, okay. And so I got some scissors. I trimmed off the moustache around this hole. And I thought, it was a slightly ragged cut. And I thought, I really ought to trim this according to the book. But I don't really like to do that. So anyway, I chickened out on that. I didn't do it, unfortunately. And then I got the medical kit out and, you know, the sutures thing. I said, right, now I'm going to clean you up, and then I'm going to stitch this for you. So I got his face cleaned and so on. And I said, do you want a local anaesthetic? He said, well, I don't know. So I got the needle and I poked around his lip. You see, I said, can you feel that? No, right, you don't need an anaesthetic. And I said, okay, you ready? And he said, I think I'm... threw up. So I had to stop, swab him all clean again, you see. And then I put the stitch in, and well, that was the end. It was only one stitch. And that was the end of it. He's still got the scar to this day because I didn't trim the edge of the wound. I was very embarrassed because I don't think he would have done it on his own. And I mean, I'd done quite a bit of climbing as an undergraduate, including some snow climbing on Ben Nevis in the winter. But we perhaps should have been better equipped. Should have had a rope, I suppose.
Let's take a break.